Talk Show. Recorded good live.
Evening. good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I am bringing you tonight's Heretics Hour from our Talk Show station, where I have a Heretics Hour page. And I want to thank Mr. William Fink for making this possible and running the show in the background tonight. I could not possibly do it. I can't. I don't even know how to do that yet. But even if I learned, I don't know that I could run my own show and star in it at the same time. So I really appreciate him. The reason that we're coming from Talk Show is because there was no response for 1 week since last Monday night from Reason Radio, and I could not know whether I was going to have a show. I tried very hard to get in touch with people there up to the last minute, and now at the truly like 2 minutes before 8, I was contacted. But it's too late now because I've already set this up. So this show will run tonight here, and it will be archived at my website after the show. It'll be there by morning for sure, so you can, people who missed it or got confused, you know, didn't know where it was, are listening right now over at VOR to a rerun, will hopefully find their way to it, and they can listen to it where either on this Talk Show page or at my website. Now, I want to say one little thing about my new website, CarolynYeager.net, and that's it. My RBN radio shows from May through August this year are available for download and podcast listening free there now. And I've just completed writing a description for each show, so you can now know in advance what it's about. You don't have to take potluck when you're trying to listen to one. Just click on the Republic Podcast link on the front page menu above the image of my Auschwitz tour book, and you'll go to them. They're in order of the first to the last, because so many of the shows were kind of continuations of the day before. It was most of the time it was a Monday through Friday show, so there was a lot of overlap. Now, all my Voice of Reason podcasts are also available at my new website. They are not, they're mostly just identified by date now, not by topic. That will be coming, but it takes a little while to do all that. But they are there, and they will continue to be put there. So they're kind of like safely archived there in case anything would happen anywhere else. Now, my guest knows all about the importance of archives, as she has achieved archived, I mean, all of her letters to the editor that she has written on a website of her own. This website is cbmiller.com, cbmiller.com. I recommend that you go there and spend some very enjoyable time reading at your leisure. What she says will certainly invigorate you, I'm sure. Hello, Christine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Caroline, give me 1 second.
Yes.
I have two pussycats here, and they are fighting. I want to put them
all
in
right.
front of
well,
the door.
All right. Well, you go right ahead and take care of them.
Just a minute.
I'll just tell people that your name is Christine Miller, which I haven't said yet, and you have published two books. One is a book about your father's war diaries from the Eastern Front in World War II.
Caroline?
And the other one is
okay.
Your letters. Yes, Christine.
I bought it. I kicked it. They bought it the door open. I had some. I locked them out, but they bought it the door open
okay. And
started to fight.
Okay. Well, I was telling the listeners about your books. Now, why don't you go ahead and tell us about your books. Your first book is which was only published last year. You put it all together from your father's war diary and other materials that you had, that he had. It's all him, though, and you don't even put your name on it except as that inside you're under the copyright and so on. You know, you say it's by him. And it's just one of the – it's a very, very special book. It, as I told you when I st- started reading it, I just couldn't put it down. I didn't want to put it down. It just kept going from one part to, and it's got lots of illustrations in it, and we're going to talk about all of that. But tell us about yourself a little bit and about your father and how you came to put this book together.
My father.
Like, where were you born? Start
okay.
In the beginning.
Okay. Well, I was born in Germany in a small kind of village in Münsterhausen, which is between south of Augsburg, and so on a day once a year, we could see the Alps rising like a wall. Okay, on the south. So that's and I was an illegitimate child, but very dearly beloved by my father, and he acknowledged me, took care of me, decided that I should get an education, but when at the age, naturally he could take care of me. So I was sent to my great uncle who had a little farm, and there I spent a very happy childhood with cats and dogs and cows. So it was a small farm. That was we had 6 cows and 1 heifer. And the cows were used as draft animals. So they did the plowing, they pulled the wagons. And naturally, we were dirt poor. But we were not aware of our poverty because you are only aware of your poverty when you can compare yourself to somebody who is better off than you are. Mm-hmm. So we were all in the same boat. And we were very content and rather happy. Naturally, the war really was devastating the community because the farm, a small farm next to us, the husband was killed in action, and the woman had to do the whole work. The next door to us, on the other side of the street, the family lost 3 sons, so there was rarely or barely a house where either the father wasn't killed or the sons weren't killed.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and then after the war, okay, at the end of the war and after the war, the people from the cities came, okay, and they brought all their valuables, okay, to trade it for food. So and the beggars came, endless. They wanted a piece of bread. They wanted a spoonful of flour, a spoonful of fat. They wanted an egg, which they never got. But so we didn't consider ourselves poor because we had potatoes, we had food to eat. So the poor people were the beggars in front of our doors. And then naturally, in 1956 came the people who were evicted from the Sudetenland.
In 56?
Sorry, 46.
Okay.
46.
All right. Good.
So our
now population. Your father went your father was he drafted into the war?
Oh yes, that was.
He was a young man then.
Yes.
Yeah, because there's pictures of him in here, and he looks quite young.
Yes.
And how well did you knew him quite well then? I mean,
oh yes.
Were you raised by him?
What did you say?
Were you raised by him,
or were you
raised by your mother?
No, I was raised by by my great uncle and his aunt and his wife.
Yeah.
So
well, from the time you were how old?
4.
Oh, yeah. So who were you with before then?
Before then, I was with my mother. And actually, she had to work. So she worked at different places, and I was, which I don't remember then, I was with different people while she worked.
Yes.
But when I got to Münsterhausen, that was then, I considered that my family.
Yes.
And
now you're telling us that you didn't feel deprived. You didn't feel like you were scarred emotionally or mentally by any of this. You were quite all right, and you are a very psychologically healthy person.
But,
I know that just from reading your
letters. My mother told me to call my aunt. And I think I must have had a very natural instinct. I called her mother.
Uh-huh.
So to me, and my uncle, I called him pop, dad.
Okay.
Because...
All right, so things were pretty good until a certain time. Then what about the end of the war, the bombing that you witnessed Allied bombing?
Yeah, my mother, she visited periodically, and one time she took me to her father and her stepmother in Augsburg, and I must have been about 6 or 7, maybe 6, but I was pulled out of my bed at night, and we all stumbled down to the cellar, and I heard the crashing of the bombs, and when it was finally over, I had peed in my pants. It was horrible, but this wasn't a major attack. That was a minor attack, so it wasn't at our house wasn't hit, but naturally I heard the bombs fall, the noise of the bombs falling. And Augsburg at that time had an airplane factory, MAN. And so the first air attack was mostly to the industrial area. But naturally, later Augsburg was very much destroyed.
All right, and you write later about Pforzheim. I don't know if you were near that.
Saw
that the year afterwards.
No. Pforzheim?
Okay, but we'll talk about that later. While your father was in the war, during the war, it appears that he was writing to you quite a bit.
Oh, yes.
Did you get letters from him?
Yes, always.
Yes,
and
okay.
And there's the book. Some of the minds.
They're quite endearing and really wonderful. So he was thinking about you.
Oh, very much so. I mean, if you will I never see Mike Crystal again when he was, when he was afraid that he would be torn to pieces. But I was his one and all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it appears so. It appears so. So let's get into the book a little bit. I've got two books. Now, this first one, your father's book, is his name was Heinz
Postenrieder. Right.
Postenrieder. And it is called, translated into English, A Campaign in the East, August 2nd, 1941 to April 19th, 1942. Now, I'm not clear if he was if he became a prisoner of war at that point.
No.
April 1942, or if why does his war diary stop there?
I don't know. Maybe
okay, that's
it
all
was,
that you have up.
Yeah. Maybe there was more fighting. Maybe he couldn't continue it on, or I have no idea why it stopped. Okay.
Maybe it got lost, or was he sending that home to you and your family?
No.
As he was writing it, or was that all found later?
That,
did he bring it back with him when he returned?
No. That he must, as far as I know, he must have sent this diary. These were two little notebooks and the photo notebook. He must have sent that to a family where he worked for. He was an optician Okay, and that, I think that family kept some of his things. And after the war, when he came back, he retrieved it.
Okay. All right.
Now,
your book is full of pictures, illustrations, photographs. You even have a section of 16 pages of color plates of this wonderful Christmas
letter
that he sent to you in 42, Christmas 1942.
Yes.
Just lovely. And we'll get into that. I'm going to kind of go through the book, from front to back. I've got a few things to bring up. And if there's anything special that you want to say that I'm not covering, you go right ahead and bring it up. Now, first I want to say that these books are not for sale. Maybe they don't have any price on them. You sent the two books to me through our mutual friend, Gunter Deckert.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't read them for a while because I didn't get to it. And when I did, I just was really taken by them. But I'm wondering if you just hadn't gotten around, can you make them available to people?
Of course. Well, I usually, if somebody wants these books, I send them out. You know, I pay for the postage. Maybe if you can give me a donation of $10, then I send them. You know, free of. I pay the postage then. So just to defray a few.
But word of mouth. But you think you might be able to get more of this on your website,
yeah,
so that people can go there and then they can order the book. You can either put a price on it, or if you just want to ask for a donation, or
$10 would be fine. Well, you know,
that's it. You're so, you know, you just want to get them out and give them away. But you know, I'm just suggesting that you might sell them and put a price on them.
Yeah,
it makes it easier. Sometimes people prefer it that way. Then they know, you know, what's what, and they don't.
Yeah.
They might not know how much to give you for a donation or whatever. But
yes,
however
yes.
you want to do it. But I do think they should.
Are right. I say $10. Okay. But I want to say.
Oh, that would be cheap.
Hmm? Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I said that would be quite a bargain, $10 for the book. But I know that sometimes it's important that material just gets out there, and I really think this is a wonderful.
Right. Yes.
And now the book also has a lot of maps in it. Are these maps drawn by your father that go along with the diary?
Right. Say that his
he
map.
He was quite an artist, wasn't he?
Oh yes, he was a good photographer. Well, I think the reason he drew the maps was he always wanted to know where he was. And
he was a very intelligent man. I can tell that.
Oh yes.
And you are very. I don't mean to be bragging about you too much, but you are clearly a very intelligent woman, so you inherited brain from him. But here he has done these beautiful maps. And then he's done all these drawings in the letters that he wrote to you. And then his photography is quite good. And I will say here, before I forget it, that he had a camera with him. And a lot of soldiers tried to have cameras. They all wanted to take pictures, but a lot of them didn't. And so he took as many pictures as he could, and then he would sell prints to the other soldiers. And he had quite a little business going, and it wasn't so much to make money, but because, you know, it was a service to all the soldiers. They were real happy to get him because they wanted mementos, you know, to send home or to take home of what they saw there. And some of the pictures, they're just really interesting. You won't find them anywhere else.
Well, he was a good businessman.
Well, he was smart.
Yes. Well, as far as my smartness, I don't know. I mean, you know, intelligence doesn't come as a lump sum. I'm good at one thing and very bad at others.
Well, you have a real clear thinking mind is what I would say after reading all your letters to the editor. But we'll get to that. Now, he is, so this is what you'll find in the book. Now, I'm going to ask you about a few things. And then, if there's anything you want to talk about that I don't mention, you go ahead. On page 31, there's a poster or a flyer in Russian from 1941 with a drawing of Stalin. It looks like with an army general and a pilot and a big number 13 on it. It was some kind of propaganda flyer, I think.
Well,
Do you know what that was about?
Yes, I think that was a leaf from a calendar. You see, it has a 13.
Oh, that was a calendar.
Yeah, it was just one. I think it
13th
was
13th of the month, whatever month it was.
Yeah. So
Well,
you know, he knew Russian quite well, and he knew how to write it too. But so that's what naturally he pasted that in his diary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, one thing I want to say about that book, I mean, the reason I published it is, you know, the German soldiers has that reputation of being, you know, feeling like a member of the master race in Russia and looking at the Russians as an inferior race. Now,
mm-hmm.
If you read the book, you don't find a hint of that, of that mentality. So,
that's right.
And naturally, it's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when I first found out that I was supposed to be a member of the master race, here in the United States...
Okay.
Because when I grew up, I never ever heard that I was supposed to be a member of the master race. The only thing I ever heard was that I was a rather inferior specimen of the human race.
I mentioned that just recently on the program that I don't think that master race was a phrase that was used by the Germans or by the National Socialists.
I never heard
it. That was used by their enemies to, you know, accuse them of that. But they never said that.
I never heard it. Okay, but I mean, maybe.
No, and in the book, as you say, your father shows that he likes the Russian people, and they didn't always treat the people as well as the people would have wanted to be treated because they were an army. They had to move through the territory. They had to eat. They had to take care of themselves. I mean, they weren't there to take care of the local people as they moved through, but they weren't there to be barbarous or to be cruel to them or to give them any extra hardships that they didn't have to do.
What always surprised me how the Russians were helpful to the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, yes, and likewise, as your father seemed to really like the Russian people, that the Russian people liked him, and they liked a lot of the Germans, and a lot of them were quite happy and were helping them out and so on, and, of course, they'd cook for them. But it was... right here, I'll just say that from the beginning, I was kind of surprised in the diary entries that right off the bat, things were tough for him and his. He was in a brigade, was it? No, not. What am I trying to think of? Not a brigade, but anyway, they were under a lot of fire.
Okay.
They had a terrible time. I mean, it was tough for the Germans. I mean, you'd think, you know, this is the beginning. This is in early August 1941 it starts out.
Right.
And so the Germans were supposed to have been doing so well then, just victory after victory, you know.
Uh-huh.
And yet he was down kind of in the middle. He wasn't in the northern part, middle to south. But they were moving through, and they underwent a lot of attacks from the Russians, and a lot of soldiers died and were wounded. They seemed to be under fire a lot, and then the weather was not good either. In that already in September, October, there were these rains and everything turned to mud, and you get a firsthand view of what it was like when all of their vehicles were caught in the mud, and they were spending all this time and energy using logs and everything, trying to dig them out and get them going again. And somehow they kept moving.
Yeah, what I want to say is, you know, it's always said that it was a Russian winter which defeated the German army. No, it was a Russian mud.
Yeah. Well, there are some pictures that are really amazing of this mud.
But, you know, my father told me they came into one village, and it was just, I mean, the village street was just a mud field. So anyhow, you know, the German generals always want to keep their army occupied. So they decided, they decided to clean the street. And the Russians then were absolutely amazed that under the mud there appeared a solid street. So they couldn't quite believe it.
So there was a street underneath all the mud?
There was a street underneath all the mud, right.
Oh, that is kind of strange.
Yeah, so that was surprising to the villagers.
Well, they didn't know it.
No.
Okay. Well, these people were living in very primitive conditions. They are very poor. All these Russian peoples, for the most part, the group that he was with was going through. Now, on page 43, there's a nice picture of a little blonde-haired girl with a hair held back with
yes.
a ribbon. And it's you, obviously. I didn't realize all these pictures were you when I
That's
first
me.
Started reading
yeah.
the book. I'm saying, well, there's somebody. Anyway, she's sitting on a big stone, barefoot. And so was this a picture he took of you at one time, or was this a picture you sent? Was that you
no,
and your
that,
family sent
that
to him,
was,
or what?
That was in his diary, too. He pasted that in his diary.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, well, it appears so he's got something written under it.
Okay. He said,
where did he get it?
Well, he took it. That was when he was on furlough.
Okay. I was going to ask you, was he able to come home any time during the war?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I remember him coming home once. Okay.
Yeah, there's some pictures of him in his uniform with you.
Yes. So he came home on 2 weeks. So that was when he was on furlough.
Well, the book, the war diary ends in April 42. So when was he taken as a prisoner? How long did he spend as a soldier in the war?
1945.
Oh, he was all the way to 1945.
1945, yes. But as I said, there might have been some more diaries, but when I went through his what he left behind, that's all I could find. He
yes.
wrote a couple of
okay.
more things about the city of Trubchesk, and but the diaries ended there. So either he didn't have time or the diaries were lost. I do not know what happened.
Yeah, well, it may be that he just didn't feel like he could continue writing a diary.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Situation going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I'd be interested to know what all. Now, he was a radio operator.
Right.
Did he continue that all the way through? He started out as a.
Right.
They made him a radio operator.
Right.
So he was
yeah.
constantly carrying. He had to look after the radio, and
right.
He was carrying it around with him, and he was with a few other guys, and they had a vehicle a lot of the time, and they carried all their radio equipment in it, you know, along with the rest of their troops. And then sometimes wherever they settled, they had string bunch of wires all around,
right.
and you know, trying to get in. So that was a big job for him. He wasn't actually. Then he had to fight, but he wasn't actually one of the fighters because he was a radio operator. But
right.
he still
right.
had to fight and defend himself at times. And
right.
And of course, they're under shelling and so on too.
Yeah.
But
well,
that's only in the first year, so we don't know really what happened after that. All right. Now on page 43, that's what I did. On page 53, there's a photo of him by him of a Russian couple, and you say there that this was his most popular photograph.
Right.
That was most frequently purchased. It's a very good picture.
Yeah, you know, I'm just this picture always touches me, because how his wife, how she holds on to him, and he is, you know, in spite of fact that he is dressed in a old raggedy jacket, he is rather proud, isn't he?
Oh yes, they look actually fairly prosperous, these two.
Yeah.
Compared to what some of them look like.
Yeah,
but they do look like, definitely she looks very peasanty.
But he's
a very tall and strong looking.
Yeah.
Good
looking.
Proud looking.
Proud looking.
Good looking, yes.
But
yeah,
I'm always touched by how she holds him with her hand on his arm. So
yes.
Yeah, that's a very, very nice picture.
Well, often in the diary, your father is saying, oh, I was able to take a lot of good pictures here, or, you know, wherever they were at the time. And they were always on the move. I mean, that surprised me, too. They didn't go somewhere. They were constantly having, I guess they were moving deeper into the interior.
Yes.
And
yes.
Sometimes they had to retreat, and, you know, then they had to go a different way. They ran into all kinds of difficulties. But they were just always on the move. If they stayed anywhere for 2 or 3 days, it was great, because then he could wash some clothes, or, you know, if they had any peace and quiet for a while. So it was tough. It was very, I got the impression.
Yes.
It was very tough, but he had a good attitude. Now, I want to bring up something here on page 101, and it actually starts a couple pages back where they, this is September 23rd, 1941, They had come, so this is I'm starting on page 97 now. They had come to some place, and they were staying in some house, some Russian house, and the people, you know, they would just move. The people would kind of, I don't know that they willingly did it, but they gave them the hospitality, and they let them stay in their house, or they cooked for them and so on, or they found an empty house or something. Anyway, he said, we wash and cook, and Helmut brings three roosters.
Yes.
Well, then
yes.
They have to go. They have to leave and go somewhere else. And so just before they got to eat the root, you know, before they got to eat. So then they get to another place, and they sleep in the house opposite. It says a young girl is there. Helmut is aggressive. Now, at first when I read that, I thought of him really being aggressive, you know, coming and going after that girl. But I realized later that that's not what he meant. He just meant. So he says he wants to have her, your father is writing this, but he is out of luck. He is just too obvious. I report back to the chef. He does not say much to the chief. Well, I think Helmut was just trying to make up to that girl.
Well, of course.
He was trying to get that girl's attention in a kind of an obvious way.
Yeah,
turned him off. But, yeah, he wasn't, like, trying to grab her or anything.
Well, he was not allowed
and
to. Because,
what?
I mean... My father witnessed one time his company had to assemble, and at the execution of a German soldier, because the German soldier had raped a Russian woman, so
yes.
he was executed,
mm-hmm.
in front of the whole group. Okay.
There were a number of those cases, and I've always kind of felt bad, but they had very strict rules, and the National Socialist Party insisted, and in the Wehrmacht they had these very strict rules too, that they felt if they didn't have very strong discipline, then they couldn't succeed, and
exactly.
So that's what they did, and some people. Maybe, unfortunately, were killed, you know. Good Germans were killed because they had let themselves get carried away. And it's kind of too bad that they had to have such a tough...
When you have an army which is on the move, which is moving forward, you have to have that discipline. When the Russians occupied Germany, the discipline was completely gone. And
they didn't even ask them to be disciplined. They told them not even to be disciplined.
No,
yeah,
they wanted
terrible.
the Ilya Ehrenberg incited the Russians to take the German women as your booty. And
yeah,
let me tell you a story. It's a little bit, I don't know. Well, you can judge for yourself.
Go ahead.
But anyhow, I have a half brother, Olaf, and he was my father's paramour for a little while. Okay. So anyhow, after the war, okay, and it was 1953, she came to visit him in Pforzheim. At this time,
this woman who was your father's girlfriend.
Yeah, so girlfriend
okay.
is a okay. My father had many girlfriends.
Okay,
he was charming.
Well, obviously, women liked him. I'm going to finish this story, but there'll be a nice contrast to what you're going to say.
But
now.
Anyhow, so at this time, she lived in the East Germany. So at this time, the border was still open. So she visited him in West Germany, in Pforzheim. So anyhow, now Hannah in East Germany, when the Russians came, she was repeatedly raped. I mean, the women were just, I mean, there was barely a woman who wasn't raped.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, so she came, Hannah visited him in Pforzheim in, I think, 52 or 53, sometimes at that time. And she told my father, well, I can't get pregnant anymore because I had a DNC. So naturally, mm-hmm. that is nonsense. Women who have DNC still can get pregnant. And my father naturally didn't quite know and didn't take any precautions. And that's how my half-brother made his appearance.
Okay.
So anyhow, I told that to my half brother. You know what his answer was?
What?
I don't want to know anything about that.
About the raping.
About the raping.
Yeah.
And nothing. I don't want to know anything about that. But that is his attitude, and that is the attitude of most Germans. We don't want to know. Don't tell us anything. You know the monkey, the three monkeys?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The closing.
See nothing,
hear nothing.
See nothing,
hear
nothing.
That's the attitude of most Germans nowadays. So, okay, you go on.
Yeah, well, it wasn't always, was it?
No.
Or is it that they can't, it's too much contradiction. I think they can't deal with the contradiction that the Germans were doing bad things, or the Germans were at fault, and yet, so when they hear that it's the others, and it's too much contradiction going on, so they just would rather not hear about any of it.
Oh, they've been so brainwashed. I mean, look,
yeah.
After the war.
Well, anyway, I'm going to read this little part in your father's diary, because I think it's very sweet. So compared to the kind of raping that the Russians did, the following day, after Helmuth wanted that girl, but he was out of luck, and they slept in a house, in this house, I guess, for the night.
Mm-hmm.
Then he says, wake up call at 7 o'clock, September 24th, 1941. The battalion moves out. That's what he was with, the battalion.
Yeah.
We stay. I write in the house. So he's always writing in his spare time.
Yes, yes.
He's writing letters and
he's writing
in his diary.
Yeah.
And he says, Aushka, that's
yes.
the girl.
Yeah.
Comes to me and gives me to understand that she likes me.
Yeah.
We converse with our few words. Her mother washes my things in the yard. We are alone in the room. I take the young girl in my arms, give her a quick kiss on her sweet mouth, and ask her laughingly, what do you call that in Russian? She turns red as a beet, laughs, and threatens me with her finger. Then he gets a radio message that as soon as the bread is done, they have to go to another place. He says, the time which we have left is short, but everything good the girl can do for me, she does. She brings good, sweet things, gives me a book, writes a letter which I can't read, and gives me a small hand-embroidered kerchief. Soldiers have to move on. At the leave-taking, she kisses my eyes, my brow, and mouth so lovingly, and off they go. Now, you know, I think that was very sweet because I don't take that anything transpired between them besides
of course
a
not.
Little kissing. No, and it made the girl happy. I mean, she liked him. I mean, she just was attracted to him.
My
father had to be very attractive, and it made her happy. And it's just kind of sweet, you know. And in the midst of all this horror that goes on.
Yes, yes. Well, my father thought say Russian women to be the best.
Oh, really? Well, there's a picture in there of him walking down a street.
Yes.
In between two Russian women, and says my father with two Russian women doesn't. I don't know what that was all about, but they just.
Oh, they was dancing and they went home together and.
Oh yeah, he does write in there somewhere about a dance hall.
Yes.
That they went to
and how pretty the Russian women were and how he enjoyed himself. No, he thought the Russian women really were the best. sensitive, loving, and just very nice.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I've heard that elsewhere, so I'm sure there's a lot to it.
Yeah.
Then on page 106, on October 6th now, we're still in 1941.
Yeah.
He says he has written letters to Crystal, Troutle, Karen, and Marielle. You might have to pronounce that last name.
Okay.
I can't quite figure out how it's pronounced. But, you know, these were the people, the women he was always writing to. And, of course, the first one is you. He always called you Crystal.
Yes.
C-H-R-I-S-T-L.
Yeah, well, you know, that is really the Bavarian. The Bavarians hang on everything on L. For example, my name is Christine. Okay, so that becomes Crystal. Okay, Elizabeth is Liesel. Johann is Hansel. Margaret is Gretel. Hansel and Gretel. So it all ends in L.
Okay, and Troutle was his half sister.
Yes.
Something like that.
Troutle was his half-sister. And the other ones, Karen was my mother. And the other ones are just his varied female acquaintances, okay, who sent him packages and sent him letters. And I mean, you have to realize that at that time, during the war and after the war, I mean, there was such a shortage of men. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know. It's not just that men died or were killed, but that the women, you know, they couldn't get any husbands. The men were gone. And not only did they have to do all the work, the heavy agriculture work, but also they had nobody to help them. I mean, I saw a young kid plow with a team of cows. So,
I don't think we can imagine, you know, what you have to do when you have to do it. I think a similar situation might have been in the American South during the Civil War.
Exactly.
What they call the Civil War,
yeah,
where all the men were gone and they were dying too, and being terribly wounded. And all these women were left behind, and the fine, you know, white-skinned Southern women were now out there, picking cotton and so on.
I mean, I Gone with the Wind. I mean, you know, when I was young, I just read it for the love story. But I have reread it recently, and I read it for the history. And I still remember Scarlett when she's out in the cotton field picking cotton, and nobody, no man to help, and the marauder comes and she shoots him.
yes, that was a great scene, wasn't it?
yeah. But
I remember when I read that book, it was one of the first big books I read, you know, like adult book. And I read from morning till night.
It's a fantastic book. And I don't know, why is it not considered world literature? Is it just because the South lost? Because it's a fantastic.
Well, I don't know what that snobbery reason might be. She's just not considered one of the top.
But she is.
I don't know, but yeah, I go along with you there. There are some things that are not included that are very good and are more popular than anything else. But Gone with the Wind has made a huge impression on millions of people.
But again, she should be top, you know, with all the other top writers, because it presents what I consider a true picture of the whole period, and I think it's fantastic. Okay.
Yes, it is. Well, your book, I think, also should be well known, and I'm sure hardly anybody knows about it at this point.
No.
So let's go to page 174, and there's a.
Oh, I want to mention something. I want to mention something.
Your photographic plate.
Yeah. I want to mention.
You want to add something right now?
Yeah, I want to just mention that I offered that book to German, free of charge, just to German publishers, no takers.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, you go on. Yes.
Well, you know, they have this idea how they want to control things. This is that made me think of something. Yeah, that because people, I want to tell people that this book is in both German and English. You just start out with a few pages in German, and then you do those few pages in English, and then you switch to German and then English. So as you go along, you know, it's in both. It works very well. And if you want to compare, if you know a little bit of German and not a whole lot, that's kind of good. You can compare and learn more from it. Anyway, on this page 174, another plate with another, you can tell I like this sentimental stuff.
174.
There's a Christmas card, 174. That your father made. It's so beautiful. It's so Bavarian. It's and even Austrian. I mean, the way he's got a picture of you holding your brown teddy bear, and then he's got this beautiful flower dried.
That's Edelweiss.
On there, and he's got the page all decorated with a little Christmas wreath, and he says on there, "Meine Crystal."
Yes.
My crystal, down at the bottom. Did he make this and send this to you, or?
No.
Did you find it there in his stuff later or what?
That was in his diary.
Oh, so he, you know, it's really touching how much time he spent thinking about you and creating things for you. There's another darling little letter here with a picture. He's drawn a little choo-choo train at the bottom and the sun shining. But then we have, and then there's another one, Meine Herzl. How do you pronounce it? Herzl.
Crystal.
My heart. My little sweetheart, or whatever.
Crystal is Christine. It's an abbreviation of Christine.
Oh, that says Chris. I thought it says Herzl. H.
My name Chris.
E R Z L E.
C H R I S T L.
Okay.
That's.
I won't go on any more of these pictures of you because I've maybe overdone that. But then we have. The booklet that he sent you, which is, let's see, I have to get further down on my notes here. Page 252. And you've got all these color plates, 16 pages in color. It must have cost you something.
That was a letter to me, a long Christmas letter.
Yes, beautiful. Beautiful. It's page after page, and he's got it handwritten out. He's got little drawings and decorations. I mean, I never got anything like this from my father. I think it's marvelous that he did all this while he was in a war, you know. So even though you didn't get to see him much all that time, he did try to make up for it by sending you all these things. It's just darling. And there are pictures of him at the end of it. And then there's some more pictures at the end, a lot of his photography and a couple more letters. Well, you translated that Christmas letter at the end there so people can read what it says. And that's it with this book. It's very nice, and I hope, William Fink has Krista Guinea. He does. I just mentioned before the show. I mentioned this to you.
Yes.
He does. And I mentioned it to him too.
And
he said, yeah, he would take a look at your website. You know, he builds websites for people. And he could fix up your website. You said you wanted somebody to do that. And
I'm very happy to pay him for anything he does. I mean, I always, you know, if he wants to do that, I'm just very happy. And as I said, I'm very happy to pay. And as far as my website is concerned, I have so many more letters, okay, before say, Marshfield News Herald cut me off, I have more, and I want to put these on the website too. Now, I don't know, how do I do that? Do I have to retype that, or can he just take them from the newspaper?
Well, I think they have to be retyped, or otherwise they just look like the newspaper. So, yeah, they would have to be retyped, and then they're just moved on there. But you can talk to him about that later.
Okay.
It won't be difficult for him. To do it, and then you'll
where
you'll
is he? Is he is in Texas too?
No, he's in New York.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter with internet, you know.
Yeah.
We can be anywhere. All right. Now we've brought up your letters to the editor. So your second book is Reality Check.
Yeah.
And when did you publish this book? At the same time you published your father's diary?
No, that was first. And does it say
something?
Oh,
this is the first one you did.
Yeah,
okay.
That is the first.
It doesn't have a copyright date in it that I can see.
Huh. I don't
know. Yeah, so you started writing. All right, now talk about your life in the, if you have anything more to say about Germany, fill us in a little bit. You know, so after the war, you lived there. How about, well, this is in one of your letters, your trip to Forsheim.
Yeah,
but you know, it was in mid 1950s that you moved to, you emigrated to the United States as a single woman.
56,
a young woman.
Yeah, I was okay. When my father came back, he was one of the earliest one to come back. A cousin of mine didn't come back until 1955 or so. He was there for 9 of 10 years. Okay. But anyhow, when my father came back, he decided I had to get an education. But where I was in Münsterhausen, there was no, that was just a village, and it was a village school. So from, let me see, then to 50, then from 48 until 48 until 53, I was at a Catholic convent school, and then after that was just for 6 years, okay. And after the 6 years was over, then I moved in with my father in Pforzheim, and I lived there for 3 years in Pforzheim, until I came to the United States in 56. And there I made my Abitur in Pforzheim. And when I was done, I didn't quite know what to do next. So a friend of mine told me, well, come to us. And said,
okay, well, tell us about Pforzheim. You know a lot about that. That is one of the cities that is talked about a lot, but it's not one of the largest ones. So most people don't know anything about it, how it was destroyed.
Well, Pforzheim was destroyed by the English, okay, and that happened a few days before Dresden, and it was utterly destroyed. The whole.
Happened a few days before what?
Dresden. You know, the city of Dresden.
Oh, a few days before Dresden. All right.
Right.
Sorry.
Okay. I think it was destroyed February 23rd, 1945.
Yes, that's what you have written here.
Okay.
February
23rd. It was when my father came back from war, okay, he knew, had a friend in Pforzheim. And so that's why he moved to Pforzheim. And he looked, he wanted to open his own shop. And then he found a basement which was still usable. Okay, and he cleaned it out by himself. It was a cellar. I cleaned it out, and that's where he opened his shop then. And I stayed with his, he had a girlfriend, that my father had girlfriends, you know. So I stayed with his girlfriend, who was very, very sweet, and I wanted nothing more than my father to marry her. But my father at that time, he fell madly in love with somebody else. His old girlfriend, her uncle came from the United States, saw her and told her, "You are going to be my wife. You come with me to the United States." And she did. And she sent, and her husband gave me, vouched for me. And that's how I came to the United States in 1956.
Well, that worked out well, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I really got much more help from basically strangers than from my own mother. Not that my mother was in any way not helpful. Yes, she was, but I got more help from strangers. Mm-hmm. And Trudel was very, very nice, and her husband, he didn't, you know, he vouched. My own aunt didn't vouch for me, but Trudel and her husband did. And then I wanted to go to college. Okay, came in 56, wanted to go to college. And then I worked for a year for a Mrs. Friedman in New York City as a nursemaid. And I tell you, if you want to get to know people, you work as a maid. That really tells you a lot about people. Because
I imagine so.
And Mrs. Friedman, she still owes me $100. And I tell you, at this time, I could spare $1,000 at this, when I was working for Mrs. Friedman. When I left, she never paid me on time. But this $100, that I really missed that.
Yeah, you needed it then, didn't you?
I needed it then very badly. And then I went to college for 3 years, because I got 1 year for the work I did in Germany, and I took as a major I took German because I had to get out of I had to get done pretty soon. You know, I didn't have any money. I didn't have any family. I didn't have took the easiest way out. So I majored in German and in French. And then, 1960, my husband and I got married. And I tell
you. All right. Now, before we go on any further, you know, I just want to throw this in here because you've got it in one of your letters to the editor. Back to Pforzheim.
Yeah.
You say that in the spring of 1946, so that had been 1 year after the end of the war.
Yeah.
You were riding a trolley car.
Right.
You became rather apprehensive from a sickening sweet smell. And you were with a friend, and your friend told you, "Don't let it bother you. It is just from the dead bodies which are still underneath all that rubble. It always happens when the weather warms up." And, that was just that in a year later, there were still all these dead bodies under the rubble, which hadn't been able to be removed yet.
Yeah.
This was what it was like in Germany. And you say, "I know of no German or Austrian city of any size which was spared except Heidelberg." And that is true. I've heard that before. And what is that little a rhyme? I've heard that before too, but you mentioned it, that your mother told you that.
Heidelberg, du Schöne, wir werden dich verschonen, denn wir wollen in dir wohnen. Oh, Heidelberg, you beautiful, we are going to spare you because we want to live in you. So naturally, Heidelberg became headquarters.
Yes, exactly. They didn't touch Heidelberg, and then they made Heidelberg the headquarters for the American occupation.
Right, right.
And all the buildings that were still standing were taken up by the American occupiers, such as the court in Nuremberg and so on, the Justice Building, and so on it goes. Well, all right, so you were telling us about coming to the United States, and so you got your degree in German, and then you married, and you were living in Marshfield, Wisconsin, where you lived ever since, right?
Yeah, 1970. We came to Marshfield in 1970.
Okay, and then you had three children.
Yes.
And you you taught in the high school. Did you teach in the Marshfield High School or in a different high school?
I taught at I did some substitute teaching in the junior high school. I saw out a teacher had a heart attack, and I taught a semester there. I taught German and Latin. So and actually my Latin was very rusty, but I did all right. I had a good group of kids. And then I got a job at Columbus, that is a Catholic school, to teach German. I taught German there.
Okay, so your main teaching was done at a Catholic school.
Right. And then,
and you are Catholic. I mean, you were born and raised Catholic.
Right, right.
Like most people in Bavaria.
Right.
Right. And you have been a good Catholic. Now, your letters are very revealing. So I don't know when you decided to write your first letter to the editor of the local newspaper, the Marshfield News Herald, but the earliest one I have is from 1995. That actually I got that one from your website, but I haven't checked in the book, which I read all
I
of them in the book.
I have to look at the book, okay.
When you first started, but were you already retired from teaching when you first started writing your letters?
No, but I tell you what happened is well, at this point I was teaching and I left Columbus, and I tell you why. Okay, I quit Columbus because it was an issue about smoking. We non-smokers finally got a non-smoking faculty room, and we liked it very much. And then a new principal came, and he decided, well, non-smoking and smoking faculty rooms, that's too divisive. And
divisive.
What do you say?
I think that's funny you call it divisive.
Did I say it right?
Because otherwise, non-smokers are forced to be, you know, breathing the smoke.
Yeah.
You know, so that they're not divisive.
He decided one faculty room, and he made it smoking. And I said, darn it! I mean, I'm not going to. I want to eat my lunch in a smoke-free environment. And then I quit. Because, you know, we teachers, we had to check the bathrooms that the kids would smoke. And there, from the faculty room, the smoke just oozed out from underneath the door.
Oh, sure.
So I quit. And then I got another job at Stratford, which is where my son lives now, which is about 10 miles from here. That's a public school. Okay.
Okay. And, so how long were you teaching in the public school?
About, I think, 5 years.
All right.
And then I quit. But I tell you the reason, when I started to write my letters, when my children were pretty much out of the house. Because I didn't want to expose them to the harassment and to the malignment. And so I felt when the kids were gone, you know, off to college, I felt I finally could do what I wanted to do. And I didn't have to worry anymore about them. Mm-hmm. Because do you remember when the movie, The Holocaust, was shown in 1976, I think?
This
remember
was the
that?
TV series?
Yeah, TV series. The TV series.
Okay.
You know, my,
yes.
my youngest, my Bill, came home every day crying because he was mercilessly harassed.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Even though, just because he was German?
Because they knew me that I have an accent. Okay, they knew I was German. Oh, yes. So every day
just
he came home.
For that reason.
Every day he came home. Okay, and I finally decided I'm going to talk to the teacher, you know, and to say, wait a second, okay, that's unfair to do to the kid. And there was a nun over at Columbus, and she told her class, you know, oh, you go and watch what the evil Germans did, blah 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 blah, and my oldest brother at home, and I complained, and I think she finally stopped it, but it was bad. So,
all right. Let me get to the right place here. All right. No, there's a caller, Christine. And
yes.
We do. I am in the habit of taking calls in the second hour, and there's still a lot I want to talk to you about. But let's go ahead and let this caller come on and see what he wants to say to you. All right? And
yes.
Do you need to take a break or anything?
Nope.
Okay, me either. All right. Well, okay. I think the caller's name is Petter, or something like that. Hello, Petter. Can you identify yourself, please? Your name and where you're from.
Yes, this is Petter calling, and I wanted to ask Christine, has she taught both in Germany and in America, or how would she contrast those experiences?
I only taught in the United States.
And can I ask what part of the United, I didn't catch what state it was that you were teaching in?
Wisconsin.
Oh, well, can I ask what part of Wisconsin?
Central Wisconsin, in the middle.
Milwaukee area or
no, Milwaukee is down south. That is pretty much we are pretty much in the center, Marshfield. If you look on the map, Stevens Point, Marshfield, Warsaw, in that area.
Oh, is it near? How far from Madison, if I may ask?
2 hours.
Now, did you have Negroes that you were in minorities that you were teaching, or was it strictly all white kids in the school?
When we came, there were no minorities, not one. And I had no minorities whatsoever. But
And Marshfield was, you told me, you had written too, was a very German
right.
town. That's why you went there, because there are a lot of, it was settled by a lot of Germans.
No, I don't think we went there for that reason. My husband, he joined the Marshfield Clinic. Okay.
Right.
But Carolyn, Wisconsin, Central Wisconsin is an excellent place for German, what we would call German-American, you know, polka-style music is very
well, yeah,
excellent.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of Germans in Wisconsin. That's
right. It's the most heavily German state of them all, I think. So
yes, I think, well, or at least it's one of them. But, I mean, I think Central Wisconsin is especially strong. And
okay, did you want to ask anything more of Christine?
No, I just wanted to thank both of you sweethearts for being on the air. I think you're doing a wonderful job, Carolyn, and I love your new format here in the talk show. I was unable to get your show on Voice of Reason, but you seem to be coming. Have you canceled that or what? I wasn't able to even get you on there. Have you basically changed venue?
No, it's just that nobody was there until it seemed the last minute. I couldn't get in touch with anyone all week. So today I set this up in case I would need to use it. And right up until 2 minutes before 8 o'clock, there was nobody at VOR. So that's why we're doing it here. And it's working quite well. And so that's, I don't know, what's going to happen with that? That's up in the air.
It's working out wonderfully, and Leslie says hugs and kisses.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I'm not sure who that. I think I should know who that is, but I don't. But anyway, I'll maybe figure it out later. All right, Christine. Now we were going on with your teaching, and how you started. Yes, your young son was being harassed, and so you talked to the school, and then what?
Well, it's a show. What's that? How many episodes were there? About three? I've forgotten how many episodes.
You know, I remember it, and I've heard all about it since, but I don't believe I watched it at the time. But there were at least three, maybe three or four or something like that.
Well, since the episodes were over, and then it stopped. And the teacher was quite understanding and said, look, we don't talk about the Holocaust, and I think the teacher was very good about it.
Well, now let me ask you this then. Oh, as your children were growing up, how much did you talk to them about your view, your view of World War II and the German view of World War II and what you knew about?
Nothing.
Okay, you just stayed away from that, huh?
Yeah, right. Because
so they were just brought up in the, as general American kids.
Right, because the children were not interested.
Yeah, like so many, that's true.
Yeah.
They weren't interested.
Yeah.
And there you were with your German accent. Everybody knew where you were from.
Yes.
Okay. So what got you, do you remember what your first letter was about? Or what?
No, I don't remember. Okay. I didn't put them all in the books. I mean, I started earlier than what does it say here? 1994. I had some previous letters, 1993. I didn't put them all in the book. I had some other letters before, which I didn't have time or didn't have the inclination to add them. So I picked out the ones which I thought were most important.
Okay. Well, I will say that it seemed that you started out kind of slowly, and then you got for a while to where you were writing a letter a month. And I know that newspapers have a rule that you can only publish, they'll only publish one letter per month from each any reader. And so you were, you had really gotten into your stride there. And I'm so impressed with your letters because they're very down to earth, and they really get to the heart of the matter in a way. And tell us, I'm going to read a couple of them, but what kind of reaction did you get? Did you get a bad reaction right away, or were there some people who liked them and told you that, or what?
Of course I got bad reactions. And you know where the bad reactions were coming from. Mostly Jewish bad reactions, but also from Gentiles. Very bad.
Okay, so there were Jews in your town, and they immediately wrote.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, what about the letters that didn't have anything to do with Holocaust or World War II or anything like that? You had some letters that were about local issues. Now, here's an early one from 1995. Well, I can see where Jews would hate this, too. I think I'll just go ahead and read this one. It was... you have a title kind of Hearing Was Overkill. It's about the Packwood hearing. If anybody remembers, back in 1995, there was this Senator Packwood, and he was accused of sexual harassment by a few women, and then a bunch more came up, and so there was a big scandal in the news. And you say, this is so funny, you say, Packwood and sexual harassment being so much in the news, I remember the one and only incident of sexual harassment which happened to me. I had invited a neighbor couple to dinner. During the course of dinner, the husband's foot inched over to my foot and started to play footsie with it. I was so surprised that I stopped chewing, for across from me was sitting his most beautiful and charming wife, who was openly admired and I assumed secretly lusted after by the neighborhood men. I admit it wasn't much as far as sexual harassment goes, but enough to assure me in my golden years that I was not a complete asexual dog. How did the episode end? Uneventfully. I simply moved my foot, which was not pursued any further. But if it had, my neighbor would have gotten a sharp kick in his shin, augmented, if needed, by a verbal, "Cut it out." That should have done the trick. After all, I was not a lonely woman in a dark alley confronted by a rapist with a weapon. Neither were the women who said they were sexually harassed by Packwood. These women must have seen themselves as mental paraplegics, unaware that they had eyes capable of an icy stare, a mouth and tongue to say, "Cut it out," feet to kick and fingernails to scratch, feminine weapons which in the past were sufficient to keep oversexed alley cats like Packwood in their place. To have a congressional hearing is ridiculous overkill. Well, what kind of response did you get to that? But that is an example of your plain spokenness and your plain thinking that people make. You know, this you're very much against this whole victimology.
Oh yes,
that has grown in the United States.
Well, you know, I reread some of my letters, and what amazed me is the book really is kind of a little time capsule. Okay, you wanted to know
yes.
the response. Well, I had one funny response. A neighbor was, so, you know, I said a neighbor's wife. So a neighbor was accused of being it. and he thought that was quite amusing. And he assured everybody it wasn't he who was playing footsie with me.
How big is Marshfield?
How big? 18,000?
Okay, so it's small.
Yes, but we
So
have,
you being a teacher, you know, people knew you. They knew where, you know,
oh,
enough
yes.
people would know
yeah.
you. And so all this was kind of
But,
homey.
You know, we have that huge clinic, which has now, I don't know, over 100 doctors. When my husband came, he was number, 64 or something like that. But it has grown tremendously, and it is amazing. You know, before it was, now we have so many Indian doctors, black doctors, all sorts, but really multi-culti. And
mm-hmm.
and the clinic was founded by a German. And the hospital was founded by German nuns, but that is completely. We are now multi-culti. When we came, it was all homogeneous. Okay, there was no Mexican, no blackface, no Vietnamese, no nothing. But now, you know, they are pushing in. I think what they want to do, they want to diffuse the inner cities. So they are pushing the minorities into these outlying communities.
Well, sure, they don't want to have these places that are not multicultural. They're
yeah,
pushing these
yeah.
out into all the suburban and rural
right,
areas.
Right,
they,
right.
And it's kind of disconcerting.
Yes.
So you didn't get too much reaction from that, but in 1996, you wrote a letter about Holocaust. Well, it was about the bombing of Germany, but
yes.
you wrote it because you were responding to a Dr. G. You don't give his name. A Dr. G wrote a letter that he had witnessed the Holocaust, and he had
yes.
written this letter, you know, the typical stuff
yeah.
they write about the Holocaust, and he's talking about the terrible things in the camps in Buchenwald, Bergen-Belsen, and Dachau. And you wrote and talked about, and this is where I quoted from this part about Forsheim
yeah.
and the bodies under the rubble. And you ended the letter by saying, Dr. G wrote, "The Holocaust did happen. I was a witness to it." And then you say, "It just depends which Holocaust you are talking about." Now, I imagine you got some response to that one.
No.
Oh, you didn't?
No, nothing.
Okay, so everybody was just quiet.
Yeah, that was all quiet on the Western Front. No, but when I challenged the Holocaust directly, then I got nasty responses. I mean, just I will send some of these responses to you, even from my former students. I'm and again ridiculous. But
well, you all, of course, I know that. I used to write letters to the editor too. I never got into it as much as you did. But
yeah.
I was writing them for a while, and I usually got my letters published because I could write a good letter, and so the
uh-huh.
editors like good letters, you know. And there was always somebody who would respond, you know, in opposition. But a few times I got into a little Holocaust stuff. And
mm-hmm.
then it was, like you say, most people just ignore it because they don't know what to say. But here, you did it quite a bit. And here's one in 2000, you wrote Holocaust Refutation is what you've got it named on your website. But it's running for school board, you said. I was interviewed. I'll just read this first part.
Okay.
So you ran for the school board.
Oh, I'm still.
You'll have to tell us about that. This interview was subsequently written up in the paper, and reporter Miss E did an excellent job keeping straight what I said. However, one sentence I did not like was she wrote German native M. Why are you M? German native
Miller
M. Long been known for her adamant denial of the Holocaust, and then you talked about whether it was you didn't like the word denial. You thought it should be Holocaust refutation, and then you explain why. It's a fairly long letter, not too long, but fairly long. What? Tell us about that one.
What page is it? Can you? Is that in my book?
It's from March 2000. It's on your website.
Okay.
It would be in the book too, I imagine, but it's on the website. I just copied some of them from your website so I could have them here on my notes.
Gee, I don't quite.
But well, tell us about running for the school board.
Oh yeah, the reason I ran for the school board. Okay, I got all the revisionist books, the major revisionist books, into the Marshfield Public Library. I got as they have now in the Marshfield Library is now the Auschwitz myth, the hoax of the 20th century, the Ball Report, the Leuchter Report. It took some doing, but they accepted them all. Okay, and then I tried to get the same books into the school libraries, because I mean, if you look into the libraries of the junior and senior high school, I mean, they have a whole stack full of Holocaust books.
I did a study of that myself here in where I live. And I went. I got in touch with some of the school teachers and so on at all the schools. And at first they were very nice to me. And I did also look in the libraries. And you're exactly right. But I'm not as good at you as following through because I'm hesitant to go and try to get books into the library for some reason, because I think they won't do it and I don't want to get into a fight with them. But you really inspire me, because you spent a lot of time working and took a lot of abuse from these libraries and from the people in the town, from the library boards to keep pushing to get some of the books that they had removed and to get your books put in. And finally you said, well, I won't carry on about you removing these books that I think have lies in them. If you will accept the books that I want to give you free to put in, the ones you just mentioned, and you put a lot of effort into this. So, but the public library continued to refuse you, right?
No, the public library took all the books.
It was the school library that.
Yes, the public library. I had to go. They accepted all the books, but they didn't want to accept the Leuchter report. You know, mm-hmm. that forensic examination of Auschwitz. So I requested to go in front of the board. And since the board got together, and I told them, look, I mean, you are a library, you are not an indoctrination center. So look, I don't mind all these Holocaust books, but I think you should accept the Leuchter report, so they accepted it. So now, as I said, the public library has all the books. the hoax of the, you know, which I just mentioned. And after I had, after I was successful there, I went to the school libraries, and at, they had a Jew as library director, and actually they vetoed it. They didn't want to take any of these books, and that's when I started to do challenge the Holocaust books. And so they had a meeting, you know, a meeting of three people.
How many other Jews were on the school board? Isn't that interesting that a town like Marshfield, that never had probably hardly any Jews. I mean, it was just a, like it's a kind of town like you described earlier. And now by 2000, a Jew is in charge of the library at the school.
Yeah.
And how many other board members were Jews?
At the school board, I none except that one guy who was in
but
charge.
One guy was kind of running the show.
Yeah, he was running the show. And actually, what the Jew says, he always wins. But so anyhow, so then I started to challenge the Holocaust books from the Marshfield School Library. I didn't challenge the books at the public library because they accepted the revisionist books. But anyhow, I think these challenges are in the back of my book, Reality Check. So, and naturally, I always was turned down. And then I decided, well, okay, so if they turn me down, I'm going to run for school board. And because when you run for public office, they have to give you a voice. And when I'm still running for public office, I'm going to run for school board again for the coming year. And I always bring up, look, it's there all these Holocaust books in the school libraries. You have not one revisionist books. That is indoctrination. That is not teaching. And that is always the major issue. And actually, I never win. But
yeah, I imagine you have an awful lot of criticism that you should even want to have any revisionist books because they call them denial and that is kind of a sin. So do you have very many supporters?
No.
So you are tough enough to just stand there and do this all on your own.
Yes.
well, without any help, and you have to be getting a lot of abuse.
Yes, but Caroline, you know there is a German humorist, and he said, "Ist der Ruf einmal ruiniert, lebt man gänzlich ungeniert. Once your reputation is gone, you live completely unencumbered." And look, Caroline, I'm 76 years old. I mean, what do I have to lose?
Yes, you have said this to me, and you know I understand that myself. If you get old enough and you have your income, you're not worried about anything.
No. Yeah.
You don't have to worry about your family. You don't have to worry about a job. You don't even worry about your neighbors anymore. You feel very free to do what you want, and as you have said to me when we talked the first time we talked that. You think that older people are the ones who should be doing this because they don't have anything to lose.
Right.
But we find that older people remain just as frightened and unwilling to criticize.
Well, it carries over, you know, when they are young, they have to be careful. But, somebody said one time, looking at age, I see nothing good about age. I disagree. I mean, age is liberating. I mean, you are free. I mean, why should I care what somebody else says about me or feels about me? So it's a really a feeling, an exhilarating feeling to do.
Okay, well, that's inspiring. Now, and it's 9:32, so let me tell the listeners too that we will accept calls now. If anybody wants to call, go ahead and do so now. So you have said, Christine, that at some point the newspaper stopped accepting your letters. What grounds did they have to do that?
None.
Well, how did they do it? Did they just tell you that they weren't going to accept any more of your letters to the editor, or what? Or they weren't going to print them?
Yeah, what did he write? What did he say? Well, we have printed. We were so good. We were so generous to you in the past. We won't accept your letter. Finished. And I told them, I mean, you printed my letters because my letters were read. Okay, you were not so generous. So no excuse, no nothing. You know, look, they have the, you know, when they always when we always have to hear about the freedom of the press. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's the press has the freedom and we have nothing.
Yes, exactly. I'm looking at. I want to remind people what your website is. It is, again, cbmiller.com, right?
Yes.
Yes, cbmiller.com. So right. People can go there, and there are a whole lot of letters. She says there's not all of them, but there are a lot of them. And you can click on each one, and then it'll take you. You can read it. So I want people to know that. Now, when you could no longer write any more letters, you started writing for the newspaper, The First Freedom, and you are now, you are contributing editorials or a column or something for that paper, is that right?
Right. When I've, I mean, so I've translated two articles for Günter Deckert, and that took me a long time. So I didn't get to write my article, which I want to write for First Freedom. But since the First Freedom prints my translations.
Oh, that's good. Yes, I got the last one. It was something that Sylvia Stoltz had written.
Right.
And
right.
I got that from Günter, and that's where I saw that you had translated it.
Right.
And I think that's very wonderful because we're always looking for translators. James Damon does a lot of translations from German to English.
Uh-huh.
He can only do so much too. He's kind of overworked
yeah.
with it. So it's
so
great.
What's his name? Carol.
James Damon, Damon.
Damon. Where is he from?
Well, he's from right here in Texas. He's in Austin.
Okay.
Very, very fine man. He was a guest on this program a while back. He's just a great. A great person. His wife, too. His wife is very German. She seems to me, I met her, it seems to me she has just a little bit of an accent. I might be wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. But it seems to me I remember she has a little bit of an accent.
Okay.
She was born in, and raised in Germany.
Okay. Geez, that's good.
And he's not German, but he loves everything German. He calls himself a Germanophile.
But isn't that nice? There are not many of them around.
Well, actually, I think there are a lot, but maybe they're not given the space and attention that they should. So this newspaper, The First Freedom, do you want to tell anything about that or tell people how they can find it or get in touch with it? Or
I don't have it here right now, but they can look it up. I'm quite sure they can look it up. Maybe.
Yes, it's Olaf Childress, right?
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Olaf Childress.
Childress.
Yeah.
Childress. Two S's.
Yeah.
The First Freedom newspaper, he puts it out. It's full of stuff.
Yes,
it's pretty big, but it only comes out once a month, right?
Right. Maybe you can publicize his address and his. I don't have it here right now. And his email, where they can get it. So maybe you.
Well, I had the newspaper right around here, but I don't know where I put it now. So
okay.
But people can Google it. He's probably on the internet.
Okay.
Everybody is.
Yeah, the First Freedom. Okay. And I think Olaf Schalte started out simply being a newspaper promoting the South. Okay, rectifying the image of what the Civil War was all about. And but he more and more is going into revisionism now, which naturally I like. So he writes about Ernst Zündel, and he accepted the translation by Sylvia Stolz. And talking about the German judiciary, I mean, the German judiciary is completely and utterly corrupt. Well, I mean, Olaf Childress has something to say about that too. I mean, he was arrested completely illegally, so and was put in prison for a day. He didn't do anything wrong. He handed out his newspaper, and so they arrested him, and completely illegal. So
So did he have to get an attorney to get him out, or did it? You know, I mean, to point out that it was illegal what they had done, or why was he arrested? Because somebody complained.
Well,
that's usually it.
I don't remember.
Somebody complains.
I do not know. I don't remember that. But anyhow, he is suing right now because his arrest was illegal, and it's how they treated him. I mean, he had to strip. He had to undress. He was in his underpants. They took his. They took his purse away, and then he had enough money in it to post bail, but they took his money away, and then he said, "Well, you can post bail." It was unbelievable, but Olaf Schalte is a stubborn man. I don't think he gives in, and I'm very glad that he won't give in. So it's bad.
Well, we need it is bad, but we need fighters. We need fighters. Most people say, "Oh, why fight it? You can't fight it. You're just wasting your time. It's too big." Well, it is big, but we still need to fight things. And I think people are becoming more aware of a lot of this. So it's not hopeless. Now you write you have written quite a few of your letters about homosexual marriage laws which you're against, and they're very good here. And then another, you write sometimes about atrocity propaganda going back to Holocaust and the war, and they're very good too. And we might I kind of would like to read them, but then people can go and read them themselves, I guess. Then you've written. In 2007, when you possibly couldn't write to the Marshfield newspaper anymore, you wrote a couple letters to the Catholic Times about some problems in, what was going on with what the Catholic Church was doing, that you were sorry that they were had become so weak. And here you say at the end of this one letter that you wrote, about their attitudes toward the Holocaust and the war. You say, "I was born in 1935 and raised a Catholic in Nazi Germany. During this period, the Catholic and the Protestant churches were thriving. Now they are moribund, and I see why. I myself, nurtured and educated in a Catholic convent school, want nothing to do anymore with the church, which takes as reality the reflection of the funhouse mirror which the Jewish media has put in front of the Nazi period." That's very strong. That's very true. The Catholic Church seems to be just caving in getting along with Jews and making the Jews happy rather than standing for what they should be standing for.
I know in Germany the churches, both Protestant and Catholic churches, they are losing membership. People are leaving the churches. And you know, I don't know how the setup is in Germany. The German government collects what's called a church tax, which is now 8%, I think, of the income tax. So naturally, if you leave the church, if you declare that you are no longer a member of the church, then you don't have to pay the church tax. And you know, Adolf Hitler always paid his church tax. And I don't know about Göring, but I know Adolf Hitler was a member of the Catholic Church throughout his life because he paid the church tax. But it is all during the Nazi period, people didn't leave the churches, but now they are leaving the churches because the churches, both Protestant and Catholic alike, have completely caved. I mean, when Ratzinger, you know, Pope Benedict was in Germany, he exhorted the Germans to be nice to the Jews. We have to be nice to the Jews. Why doesn't he tell the Jews to be nice to the Palestinians?
Yeah, well, you know, he'll say something about the Palestinians, but he'll never say it to the Jews, and he'll never point to the Jews about it. You know, it's all such weakness. It's terrible. People just become weak and cowardly in front of the Jews, in face of the Jews. Why is that? What do you think?
Because, well, the Jews have, you know, Jewish power is a tripod. It rests on three legs: Jewish money, Jewish media, and the Holocaust. And that's a very strong tripod, and actually, the moment you want to, you know, the only leg we cannot knock out from under them is actually the Holocaust leg, because that's they are very vulnerable there. But that's why they are fighting for to maintain the Holocaust. Okay, that's extremely important to them, but. But I don't know, you know, people just...
Well, I think you have seen, as I have, that the Holocaust as long as the Holocaust remains in place, this horrible idea about Germans and German guilt and so on can never be undone.
Right.
And there are so many Germans who say they want to... do away with this. They want to reconstruct. That's not the right word, but
reintegrate, become
normalize the world attitude toward Germans. But they want to do it by saying, "Well, Hitler was a bad man. They won't touch the Holocaust. The Holocaust happened as far as they may not believe it, but they're not going to say anything."
Yeah, so
but
guilty.
Let's just say that the German people weren't responsible for it. You can't blame the German people for that. Well, that's not going to work that way.
No,
because
it won't.
As long as that ever took place and you can show that the Germans supported Hitler and so on, that's never going to be done. So we have to go to bring out the real truth about that the Holocaust is a hoax. And the real truth about World War II, which goes all the way back to World War I and all of that stuff, has to be done.
Right.
And this is a huge job of revisionism, but it can't be done without it. We can't just patch up a few things and go on.
I agree with you completely.
We're into this globalist world, globalist stuff, all based on these lies.
I mean... If the Americans would only realize, you know, how, and not only just the Americans, if the Jews would realize how damaging the Holocaust myth is to them, I think they wouldn't be so gung-ho. I mean, it doesn't only damage the Germans, it damages the Americans, and it damages the Jews themselves. I mean, they are so caught up in that victim mentality that they can't face reality in the Middle East. So I don't know.
Yes. Well, I think the Middle East has been made a problem. You know, the Middle East has held our attention since 1948. You know, I mean, it's constant. It's a constant crisis
yes.
there.
Yes.
And I think, you know, at this point, I say, you know, not very few people agree with this, but I say, let's forget the Middle East. Let's, of course, we'd have to draw American government support out of there. And then the Arabs would take care of things themselves.
Yes.
But as long as we're supporting Israel, you know, we have all the power, and we even keep them in place by our financial aid to them.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is a kind of a distraction to keep us from paying attention to our own nations and the terrible problem of immigration that's going on
in
white nations. Yes. So all of this is this is, and I find everywhere I go on these discussion boards and so on the internet, people are falling. All they want to talk about is the racist Israel. And like that's the only problem. If you can get rid of that, everything's going to be just hunky dory. It's not. It's not, because that's being used mostly as a distraction. I think to seem as though it's the only problem in the world today. Well, that gets us into a whole bag of worms there. So I won't continue with that. But
yeah,
you going back to the Holocaust, you mentioned this Ava Moses Kaur quite a bit. She
yeah.
really got your goat. She came to your town, obviously, and she came to the Catholic Church, and she gave a talk, and you said it was just packed, and you, at the end of the, at the end of her talk, you got up and said a couple of things, and everybody was like, horrified that you should question Ms. Moses. You want to give us your point of view about this Ava Moses Kaur?
Oh, I mean, she was just a, she was a, she was, a, well, I mean, it wasn't her which bothered me, but, you know, I looked around at the audience. These were educated, these were doctors, these were lawyers, and she smiled so benignly when Eva Moses Kaur told her silly, dumb jokes, and, but at the end, you know, I got up and said, well, it was Moses Kaur said, we lit candles for the Jewish children. And I said, well, how about lighting some candle for the Japanese children, for the children in Iraq, for the children in Vietnam, and for the children in Germany? But I tell you, I could feel the hostility rising against me. And one student said, Mrs. Frau, I'm glad you left when you left. Well, I said at the end, I said, look, I'm going to leave now, because if I stay here any longer, I'm going to throw up. So
that,
anyhow.
That's very hard to take when your former students.
No. My former students then said, Frau, I'm glad that you left when you left, because I was afraid they were going to lynch you.
Oh, that, I see.
Yeah, that's what mm-hmm. my former student said. Oh, no, my former students and I get along very well. So,
that's good. I'm sure your students liked you. I'm sure you would have been a wonderful, you were a wonderful teacher.
Oh.
Well, you know, this Ava Moses Kaur, I was not familiar with her book. I have never read it or read about it, but you say it's called Echoes from Auschwitz.
Yeah.
It's one of those really extreme ones where she actually believes in the soap myth, and she says,
yes, everything.
She says here, you quote her as saying, I am sure that the Germans did sit back and laugh at the Jews washing themselves with soap made from bodies of their own parents and relatives and friends. This is on page 99 of her book. And, you know, and there she is being brought in by the schools and churches there and big advertising for her talk, and she's up there talking, all these people listening. As you say, these professional people and so on, and they won't question a bit of it.
Yeah.
Even though they know that soap myth is not true. But they let her go ahead and say it.
Well, I mean, she loves the Holocaust. Well, it has
yeah.
something to do with self-righteousness, you know. You know, we are, we are not appreciated by what we do for somebody else, but how much we flatter somebody. And boy, you know, Eva Moses Kaur, she flattered the Americans. You know how good they were, how the Americans liberated them. But one thing, do you still have a moment, Carol?
Yes.
In her book, Echoes of Auschwitz, or of, I bought two of her, about both books. I've forgotten about the, in one of her two books, there was a picture in there about the children. And what she said, that's very, and the children wore the striped prison uniforms. And what she said, that when the Russians came and liberated them, okay, the Russians put the children there into these uniforms.
Yes, they did.
And then
yes.
they took repeated pictures. Now,
yes.
Then when she said that, I looked at that picture, a well-known picture, with the children in the striped uniforms. When I looked at that picture closely, you can see that these striped uniforms are really for adults and they don't fit. That they are really...
You're exactly right. And I learned this when I took a tour of Auschwitz a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And I learned this from the tour guide kind of indirectly because she said something and then I caught it and I questioned it. And she admitted that these photographs that are, like you say, they're very well known. Funny you should bring this up. Very well known are these children standing behind the fence,
yes.
a barbed wire fence, and they've got these striped upper parts of the uniforms on. And they've got the regular clothing on underneath. And they're very fat and healthy-looking kids. They're not all fat, but some of them are a little bit chubby. But and people like to point out and say, well, look, there's those kids at Auschwitz, and look how well-fed they were. They weren't starved. But the fact is, I don't think these, from what I've learned, these weren't even children in the camp. The Russians didn't take these pictures until a while after the liberation, and they got all these local children, and they put these striped tops on them, and over their other clothes, and some of them didn't even have the striped top on, and posed them there and took their pictures, and it's all a big propaganda thing. It's all propaganda, and a lot of people, revisionists, don't want to see it that way because they think it's a good point to make to say, look how healthy the children look. Well, I don't think it's good to ever go along with the untruth because in the long run, it's a lot more effective to show that the whole thing was a hoax set up by the Soviet government and the Soviet intelligence, the NKVD and so on, than to just say, well, some of the kids were well-fed, you know, because people don't care if they're well-fed. As long as they're behind a barbed wire fence, they think it's just horrible. Oh, look what those Nazis did, had those kids in that camp, you know. But the fact is, I don't know how many kids they had in there. They had some children at Birkenau. But I don't think these pictures are anything that you can rely on. The whole thing has been built up over time. As people have pointed out, the Holocaust in the beginning was a lot of exaggerated stuff at the Nuremberg trial, which they've had to admit is not true anymore. And since then, they've built it up, this, that, and the other thing, and they're still building it now, creating this Einsatzgruppen murders and the Holocaust by bullets theory and all of this stuff.
But you know,
it's new.
They're
still creating it.
Yeah. You know what is happening is naturally after the Germar Rudolph report and the Leuchter report, which proved that there were no gas chambers at Auschwitz.
Yeah.
So they are shifting. I mean,
yeah.
I've seen the stories because when I grew up in Germany after the war, we never heard anything about Auschwitz or Treblinka or Sobibor. we heard nothing about that, okay, because you have to realize these camps were behind the Iron Curtain. The only thing we heard was Dachau and Bergen-Belsen and Buchenwald. So there were gas chambers in Dachau, Buchenwald, and Bergen-Belsen. And then when the Iron Curtain lifted, okay, suddenly the gas chambers of Dachau, Bergen-Belsen, and Buchenwald disappeared, and it was all shifted to the east. And now, when the Leuchte report came out, now suddenly they are left without gas chambers, so they need Einsatztruppen.
Right, exactly.
So
that shows that. What does it show? That shows that they are making this up as they have to.
Yes,
and,
right.
I know what I was going to say. They talk about Holocaust denial and that we want to revise history and so on. Well, they've been revising it.
Right.
As you just pointed out all along.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, I like that. They are revising the Holocaust. And I always tell them, look, take Holocaust 101 and find out what stories have been dropped and what stories are current now.
Yeah.
So okay. So anything else?
Well, I think we have covered quite a bit. I'm glad we managed to cover all that we did. And I think we should end the program. We've been going for 2 hours now, and that's probably long enough. So I want to thank you very much and tell the listeners one more time your website is CB, because you're Christine B is your name. There are a lot of Christine Millers, so finding you on the internet is not easy. You have to add the B in there.
Right.
Christine B Miller, but it's cbmiller.com, and you're going to start working on that, and you're going to enlarge your website. I think you really should.
Yes, and I will contact you on by email and find out. Bring me together with Damon, okay, who does the website. And Caroline, thank you so very much. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. I thank you, and I'm just very pleased to know you. And you're just another bright star that more people should be aware of. And we will maybe do this again sometime. And in the meantime, good fortune to you. And listeners, thank you for joining us tonight. And this program will be archived at CarolynJaeger.net and also on this Heretics Hour TalkShoe page. In fact, it'll be on the TalkShoe page in about 15 minutes, I think. So tell people about the program. Let them know that we were coming from here tonight. Probably a lot of people missed it for that reason. And we'll be back again next week, one place or another, one way or another. And once again, thanks to Christine Miller, a great lady. So
equal thanks to you. Same to you.
All right.
Okay. Thanks.
Good night.
Bye-bye.